talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today, I'm happy to say, is Mike Danio. Mike is a scientist whose nearly two-decade professional career spent mostly in the pharmaceutical and biotech fields ended in late 2021 after he refused to submit to injection for so-called COVID-19 as was mandated by his then employer. Since then, Mike has spoken and written widely on scientific fraud from virology to the ongoing global pandemic, in inverted commas, operation that was launched in early 2020. He is the founder of Scientists for Health Freedom, an independent community of scientific truth tellers, as well as Science Defined. He also publishes content frequently at stillthestorm.substack.com. and video content at an Odyssey and a Rumble channel, both of which you can find if you search for Still in the Storm. Mike, welcome back. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me once again.
Hi, Jesse. Yeah, it's great to be back on with you again. Really appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So at your Substack, you recently published a piece titled "Most Published Research Findings Are False," which I'd like to get into with you. But before we do, you start out the piece with the statement, "The current state of science is dire. Over the last 40 years or so, we have effectively witnessed the death of science. It is hard to say, but what is currently put forth in labs bears little resemblance in most labs, bears little resemblance to true science." I wholeheartedly agree with you, but why do you believe this is true? Why do you think this is true?
Well, I've observed a lot of things over my 20-year career, and I've worked with and talked to a lot of scientists that I've looked up to that have been doing it for, you know, quite a bit longer than that. And the ones that have really been aware of what's going on and have asked questions, have noticed that, you know, at least 40 years ago. So, you know, we're talking sometime around the early 80s, maybe before that. Some might even argue, you know, we're talking 100 years ago, but at least 40 years ago, I think we started to see where science was trending toward taking a turn for the worse. And a lot of this, from my perspective, based on my own experience, hinges around what has happened to science as a result of it effectively becoming a business. So even the academic institutions, which used to be more of the kind of blue sky thinking where you could do more true science, where you could ask questions about, you know, phenomenon that occur in nature and the physical world and explore them, and you'd apply a vigorous process towards trying to answer those questions. That has largely become effectively like a minor league training ground for pharma, where it's utilized heavily to generate new ideas for targets and preliminary research that drives drug discovery. And so you don't even have that pure science at the academic level more. It's almost entirely captured by pharma, biotech for the purpose of profiting off of innovation and, you know, the design, the development, distribution, the sale of pharmaceutical medicines, which take a number of forms. And that means that the goal is not truth. It's not gaining knowledge about some aspect of our reality. It's profit, and it's generating medicines that, you know, I would argue largely are not needed, that they're not anywhere near effective as they're proclaimed to be. They're not specific. They carry a lot of bad effects as they're toxic. And yet the industry goes to great lengths to try to spin the information about these medicines to convince doctors to prescribe them and people to acquiesce to their doctors and others to take them. And, you know, when science becomes all about profit and about funding and where is your funding coming from, and in order to get funding and this thing, you know, you have to publish a lot, there becomes tremendous pressure to publish. And so things get rushed. You don't apply the necessary rigor in your experimental design. You don't follow up and validate data. Maybe you've not done a sufficient number of replicate experiments. Maybe you've only done something once and you publish it. I mean, all of this stuff just erodes the quality of the science and the data that's being generated. And, you know, it's over time, it's clearly led to what we observed with COVID. I mean, it was almost kind of predictable, I think, if you followed it along, that it would lead to something like that, where it would be taken advantage of at the level that we've observed.
And to add to that, what we've seen with COVID obviously is not just about profits for pharmaceutical and biotech. It's about control of populations en masse. It's about state control. So given that, can we say that science has been captured and weaponized in service of state control as well? State control of populations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where we start to get into science becoming effectively like a religion, what is known as scientism, where it's elevated to be the only acceptable source of knowledge. And that's where you get this idea that we must appeal to science. We must trust the science. It is our source of knowledge and information, and anything else is misinformation or disinformation. Anybody that questions it is, you know, is crazy and must be censored. And yeah, I mean, what's the goal? It's effectively to herd people in certain directions. And science, so when you have a system of science that's been utilized in such a way that it's become not science, but scientism, I mean, that's effectively what these kind of more dictatorial, totalitarian kind of governments are, where you have something like communism or Marxism that really is more of a scientific socialism. It was very strongly dependent on the use of science to control the populace. And that's clearly what we've observed with COVID. And there's been many throughout history that have kind of seen this coming. C.S. Lewis was very prescient about the emerging threat of a medical tyranny. And, you know, I strongly believe that's what we've seen unfold throughout COVID, largely at the behest of pharma. You know, they've certainly benefited greatly, but we've seen a massive manipulation of and herding of the population.
Yes, and I would argue that a more general way to put that hurting of the population is technocracy, that science has become or has been mutated into a technocratic endeavor that serves to manage, i.e. control populations, and also serves to manage certain sectors, very profitable sectors of production. And to reiterate what you said, it's not about making discoveries that improve the human condition. It's about making discoveries that enhance technocracy. That's, to me, what science has become.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
Undergirding that is what you write about in the Substack piece I referenced earlier. Undergirding that is the fact that most published research findings are more likely to be false than not. And in this piece, which is extensive, but in a good way, you start with the findings of John Ioannidis from 2005, if I'm not mistaken, in a piece he published called Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. So to get into this, why have you chosen to go down this route, and why is it important that we understand that most of what is published as scientific research findings are, as you lay out in this piece very convincingly, more likely to be false than not?
Yeah. I mean, it is quite a, well, back in 2005, this was a very bold and audacious claim that he make. And this essay essentially went viral, no pun intended, and was read by, you know, over 100,000 people within, you know, like the first year. I mean, it really elevated him. And, you know, because I think because it was such a bold statement. I mean, you're literally making this claim that most published research findings are false. And this is a critical element of the scientific research paradigm is peer-reviewed publication of scientific findings. Most types of funding are dependent upon publishing, especially in academic work where you're funded largely by grants. Publications, the number of times you publish per year is critical. And we see this also in industry, where there's a high requirement to publish data at different times as well. And so the fact that any given finding in any given paper could or has the probability of being false, a greater probability of being false than of being true, and that most of the findings tend more toward being false is, well, I guess it was a shocking thing to say. I'm not as shocked because I've been there, done that for more than 20 years and have spent a lot of time trying to repeat the work of others. And this gets into this idea of the reproducibility crisis, which I think was starting to emerge. Even Ioannidis talks about the high rate of non-replication of research discoveries. This would come further to light in the years that followed the publication of Ioannidis's paper, and really kind of blew the doors off of this larger crisis that it really did was systemic in nature. And I observed this throughout my career. You know, the process largely is, for a lot of scientists, that you look to the literature, to papers, to generate ideas. You look and see what has been done in a given area that you're interested in, and you then attempt to take that further, and maybe you ask questions in a different way, or you have a different idea about how to do something. And but you always want to start with, well, I need, well, if you're a good scientist, let's say, you want to start with trying to repeat what was done previously first, and not just assume that it's correct. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, many will just literally accept preclinical data at face value and just assume that it's correct. And I've seen that a lot too. But whenever I've tried to do this stuff, I always try to reproduce it, and many more times than not, findings have not been reproducible. So, you know, I think at some point I wanted to go hunting and figure out, you know, like, I knew that this was a bigger thing than just me. And because I had talked to a lot of people throughout my career that had similar experiences. And, you know, so I came across this essay, and I don't know why I didn't see it at the time. I mean, I was a scientist in 2005, but when this was published, but I just, maybe I did see it. I don't recall, but, you know, this was just really reinforced my own experiences throughout my career. What he said, and the things that he mentioned in particular that drove his claims, which largely hinge on the use of statistical significance. So if you kind of solely base your evidence that, or your conclusion that a given finding is true, based on formal statistical significance, and even more so using this thing that's known as a p-value, to basically guide your evaluation, your conclusions of your findings, you're going to be wrong most of the time. In fact, there was a statistician that, like, I think 9 years after Ioannidis wrote his paper, put out a review article and said that, you know, basically backed up what Ioannidis said. And said, yeah, if you use p-values, if you rely on them, and even if you have a perfect situation where you have a perfectly designed experiment, you're going to be wrong, you know, like a third of the time. Now, we know that the majority of the time, that's not the case. You're not dealing with an ideal situation. And you also have a lot of experiments which are considered to be underpowered. And I can explain what that is. And so in that situation, you're going to be wrong most of the time. Mm-hmm. So that's statistical significance. And then the other big one for Ioannidis was bias. And I think, you know, we can all appreciate that there's a lot of bias in science, and this can come forward in a number of different ways. He highlighted some of them. You know, I've seen this in terms of, you know, how data is analyzed, how it's manipulated and then presented. Different people can analyze data. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. and different people can analyze data in different ways and draw different conclusions, or depending on how you present things, or, yeah. I mean, and that's just one way that it can come through. There's, you know, a lot of ways that bias comes through, and, you know,
and when we factor in what we touched on a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. about the capturing and weaponization of science for certain ends, then the likelihood that findings analysis is going to be massaged so that certain ends can be achieved is astronomically high, I would say. So, mm-hmm. what is, I'm not expecting you to answer this because I think it's a huge, it involves a huge answer, but what is really being produced with most of what is done in labs and then what is put forth in papers? What are we really looking at? Is it anything meaningful? It's such an important question and one that we should constantly ask. And before, if you have anything to add to that, before you do, I just want to, with regard to the reproducibility crisis, I know this is something that you are working on writing about and have a piece forthcoming about it, but to give an example of that in the realm of so-called COVID-19, if you go to GISAID, GISAID.org, right there on the homepage, there's a little box titled HCoV-19 Data Sharing via GISAID. So Human Coronavirus 19 Data Sharing via GISAID. And to date, there have been 15,404,245 genome sequence submissions. A lot of people, I suspect, would look at this and think that there are actually 15,404,245 full genomes of SARS-CoV-2 that have been sequenced and put out there into the world's databases. But what this really is a failure to reproduce the initial assembly of a genome, a so-called genome for a so-called virus that was done way back in early 2020 by Fan Wu and his team in China. That's essentially what we're looking at, but it gets put forth as valid findings of actual genome sequences of an actual thing that exists, and none of that is true. But this all stems from the fact that you have an original process that was fraudulent, and now you have people all over the world for the last 3+ years trying to reproduce this fraudulent experiment, and they can't for very obvious reasons. And it leads to this, but it's put forth as, good Lord, look how many genome sequences of this so-called coronavirus there are. This thing is mutating like crazy, et cetera, et cetera. And that feeds into the fear factor, that feeds into the state control factor, that feeds into the pharma and biotech factor of needing to produce. Now they're talking about next generation vaccines, so-called, for this. So you can see how, with regard to the reproducibility crisis, but also a lot of what we've been talking about, this all fits together in some very dark ways.
Yeah, absolutely. The genomics itself is a big component of the reproducibility crisis. And a lot of it hinges on the bioinformatical analysis of the genomics data and the fact that it's just not reliably reproduced. So someone can analyze a set of data using their preferred software, and then somebody else can take the same set of data and try to repeat that analysis, and many times you're not going to get the same things. And in fact, that's what we're seeing with the COVID, the quote-unquote SARS-CoV-2 genome data sequences, that there are people that I know that have taken the raw data and tried to put it through the same pipelines. This is a software program that basically assembles the sequences that were used in that Fan Wu paper, and they got something different. They weren't able to recapitulate exactly, you know, the number of sequences that were generated, the sizes of the sequences, you know. I mean, how can we trust that data if you can't even reproduce it? And, you know, some people might say, well, if you can get close enough, but I mean, the other aspect is, you know, you there's no way to make meaning from that data, especially that first paper, which is the basically become the reference sequence, because you never isolated a particle to take that RNA from. So you have to make a lot of assumptions, and then everything is kind of,
yeah. Just quickly to provide context, what they did was take the BALF fluid, the bronchoalveolar lavage fluid, and feed it directly into the metagenomics program without purifying or isolating anything, to my knowledge, and generated reads from that. So you don't know what is being picked up. Now, the argument from people who dispute that say that these programs are able to sort out the junk from the meaningful material, but that's assuming that the artificial intelligence, the algorithms, are able to deal with complex systems like human RNA, and they just aren't. They don't have the capability of doing that, and thus we get what we've gotten with the Fan Wu paper and with subsequent papers, and what we've gotten over 15 million times at this point. So this goes back to what Ioannidis talked about with regard to study designs and settings. And he wrote that simulations show that for most study designs and settings, it is more likely for a research claim to be false than true. Moreover, for many current scientific fields, claimed research findings may often be simply accurate measures of the prevailing bias, which we were getting into. And you have all of that in that Fan Wu paper, that seminal paper, if I can put it that way. You have a problem with the study designs and settings, and you have the prevailing bias being this is caused by a so-called virus, and so that's what we're looking for, and that's what we're going to find and sequence and unleash upon the world.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I would even draw some more connections from that Ioannidis paper to the current situation. He goes on after he talks about statistical significance and bias, he lists a set of corollaries where, you know, if one or any of these are present, and in fact, there tends to be a lot of them present, the less likely the research findings are to be true. So one of them literally is the hotter a scientific field with more scientific teams involved, the less likely the research findings are to be true. I mean, if that doesn't speak to the current situation, has there ever been a much hotter scientific field or area than what we're observing right now, what we have observed over the last few years with COVID? And, you know, he says that when we see that kind of excitement, that's typically followed by a lot of disappointment in fields that draw wide attention. And it has to do with, you know, a lot of teams working on it with massive amounts of data being produced with an urgency in terms of the time you're trying to get that data out to beat competition or perhaps for other aspects of an agenda. And so, you know, you are going to prioritize if you're a research team putting out this data, you want to put out the most impressive data in your data set, even if it's not the, you know, the representative of the data set you have or an average or whatever. You're going to bias it by presenting the most impressive positive results. And that is obviously going to have an impact. And we've not only seen that, but what we've seen emerge and occur throughout COVID is a lot of data being put out into preprints. So they're not even going through the normal peer review process, which, by the way, is extremely broken. But they're just being put out as these preprints, which have not really gone through any review. And yet they're still being accepted as if they're true, as if, you know, this is true verified data that we can run with and use to make huge decisions. And it's anything but that. I mean, I've even seen a number of studies where the authors have been questioned about their conclusions, their claims, and have actually had to say, yeah, you know what, you know, we put this out quickly. We had to go back and kind of think about it, or as we generated more data or whatever, you know, we've kind of changed how we think about this. I mean, that's crazy when you think about how fast things have moved, how much information has come out, and how that information has been used to put forth crazy measures that have affected so many people all around the world.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, so it's just insane.
Right. And that's another way of explaining why what we're talking about here, understanding what we're talking about here, is so important, because again, a lot of people, and I was susceptible to this for most of my life. So I'll use myself as an example. I believed what came out through so-called science, which, as you've said, is more so scientism than science. And I thought that, well, all the I's have been dotted, all the T's have been crossed, and this wouldn't be published if it were false, and if it were false, it would be retracted. The peer review and quality control is watertight, and therefore the decisions that stem from the findings, the analysis that are used to justify certain measures, well, it's based on science, so it must be right. And the complete opposite is the truth. And that's been the foundation of what we've had to deal with over the last 3+ years. And it will continue to be so if we don't address these problems. And part of that is calling out and exposing the fraud of virology, but also calling out and exposing the fraud of the research that goes in tandem with virology, which is what you're doing. So I want to reiterate why it's important that we get into this, because again, it all comes back to this technocratization. I don't believe that's a word, but I'll use it here. The technocratization of science, and that is not in service of our well-being. That's to control and to harm and to kill us, as we've seen over the last 3+ years. Well, the last 2 years, 2+ years with the COVID-19 injections, but we can go back even further with so-called vaccines and look at the harm and death that they've caused as well. So I just want to put another point of emphasis on why this is important. Going back to the corollaries that you brought up, so you brought up there are six of them, I believe. You brought up the sixth one, the hotter a scientific field, with more scientific teams involved, the less likely the research findings are to be true. There were three others that stood out to me. I think all six are important, but the first one stood out to me too. The smaller the studies conducted in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. If we look at the Fan Wu paper again, or similar papers, and the sample size that was used, we're talking about an incredibly small amount of people from whom fluid or samples were taken and then used to determine that there's a new and novel coronavirus that causes the disease known as COVID-19 and that it's a global pandemic and therefore we have to shut the world down and destroy people's lives and businesses, etc. You go back to the sample size of those papers, we're talking about single individuals in some cases, maybe multiple dozens of individuals in others. But that is, when you think about that, it's almost unbelievable that that was able to get us to where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to tell somebody that we were going to have a quote unquote global pandemic that was going to affect, you know, millions and millions of people around the world, hundreds of millions, I guess, or whatever it's supposed to be. And, but yet the great preponderance of data coming out that was going to study, you know, conduct studies on utilizing samples derived from patients was going to be made up of studies that only had tiny groups, maybe one patient here, one patient there, or a handful, 5 or 10. I mean, you'd be like, that's absurd. If this is that big, you know, this thing that's affecting the entirety of the world on this level that we're supposed to believe it is, shouldn't there be just a tremendous amount of people to be able to gather samples to ensure that you have a rich and sufficiently powered data set? I mean, it's baffling that the small sample size that I've seen in so many studies, and the one that so much of it hinges on, the Fan Wu, it was a single patient. It's, does anybody try to go and directly repeat what any of these studies have done, right? No, but we just take it.
And if you read that paper, which is presented as an article on nature.com, it says that although the isolation of the virus from only a single patient is not sufficient to conclude that it caused these respiratory symptoms, which is false right there because they didn't isolate anything. But they say, although a single patient is not sufficient to conclude that it, that being the new and novel coronavirus, caused the respiratory symptoms the patient was presenting with, our findings have been independently corroborated in further patients in a separate study. And that refers to another Nature article, a pneumonia outbreak associated with a new coronavirus of probable bat origin, or the Pang Zhu paper, which was published roughly around the same time, which has the predictable problems with regard to so-called isolation. But also what's interesting in the Fan Wu paper is that in the methods section, there's a subsection, patient information and collection of clinical data and sample, that reads in part, a patient presenting with acute onset of fever, temperature over 37.5 degrees Celsius, cough, and chest tightness was admitted to the Central Hospital of Wuhan in Wuhan, who was admitted to the Central Hospital of Wuhan in Wuhan, China, was considered to be a suspected case. So why? Why was that decided from the outset that this is a suspected case of a new and novel coronavirus? And there you have the bias issue, which I think we can agree goes much more than beyond wanting to prove that there's a new and novel coronavirus. There's a bigger agenda at play that hinges on that so-called virus. But you can see there the massive presumptions built into what was done. So this person comes in with symptoms that could be accounted for by innumerable things, but let's focus on this one thing because, well, I think we can quite safely say why they decided to focus on it, but it still very glaringly points to this problem of bias and also the small sample size. And again, that's foundational for where we are now. And getting back to the corollaries, the fourth one stood out to me too. The greater the flexibility in designs, definitions, outcomes, and analytical modes in a scientific field, the less likely the research findings are to be true. Can you talk about this one? Because I seem to see this in just about every paper I read, that things are changed as the study is taking place and outcomes are redefined, et cetera, which to me, it does not seem scientific, to say the least.
Yeah, this one is a biggie, I would say, and it's where you see the idea of bias, I guess, coming through. Ioannidis actually says that flexibility increases the potential for transforming what would be negative results into positive results. And so what you observe in a lot of cases is a lot of flexibility in terms of designing a given experiment, defining the outcomes, what are you looking for? How are you analyzing the data? What analytical methods are you using? How are you presenting that data? If that is all up to the individual and how they believe it should be done, and there's no control of anything, this is where then you end up with multiple people that attempt to do the same experiment in the same lab. So just for clarity, the reproducibility crisis refers to the ability of independent labs to verify, to repeat, replicate the same data from the experiment or finding. If you have a lot of flexibility, you wind up seeing issues with reproducing data from two different people in the same lab. And I've observed this countless times where people will just, through their own biases, they will go and set up an experiment or analyze it in whatever they perceive to be the best way or their kind of favorite way or whatever's easiest to them to get it done. And then if somebody else tries to repeat it, or, you know, and they have a different way that they like to do it, they'll get a different result. Well, I mean, of course, if that's happening, that's going to decrease the probability that the finding is true, because, you know, if you can't change something and get this and still get the same result, I mean, but the more this flexibility comes into play, it just, you're playing to the biases of the individual experimenter, or, you know, even like a group. And yeah, I mean, it absolutely plays a significant effect role.
Yes, and we can see this again in the Fan Wu paper, which is so important to keep homing in on and picking apart. If you go again to the methods section and look at the subsection data processing and identification of the viral agent, which again was not done, it's not there, but it wasn't done anyway. It reads, sequencing reads were first adapter and quality trimmed using the Trim-O-Matic program. The remaining 56,565,928 reads were assembled de novo using both MegaHit and Trinity with default parameter settings. MegaHit generated a total of 384,096 assembled contigs, size range of 200 to 30,474 nucleotides, whereas Trinity generated 1,329,960 contigs with a size range of 201 to 11,760 nucleotides. It then goes on to say, skipping a little bit to the next paragraph, as the longest contig generated by MegaHit, 30,474 nucleotides, and Trinity, 11,760 nucleotides, both showed high similarity to the bat SARS-like coronavirus isolate bat SLCoV-ZC45 and were found at high abundance. The longer sequence, 30,474 nucleotides, which covered almost the whole virus genome, was used for primer design for PCR confirmation and determination of the genome termini. The whole PCR thing there is a scam in and of itself, just in this so-called experiment. But the point being that the assembly that was done, the running that was done during the assembly of the so-called genome, they were working in the same lab and got hugely different results using different programs, different results on MegaHit, different results on Trinity. And they essentially cobbled together and picked the one that they were best able to cobble together to fit, that fit the theoretical, or was as close as possible to the theoretical size of a full virus genome. So again, from this paper, a glaring example of that, I suppose what you could call flexibility, but again, it's fraudulent, I would say. It's outright fraudulent.
Yeah, I mean, that's what so that kind of, well, not much surprises me, but that really, to see that they were open about the fact that they used those two different pipeline programs to assemble the sequences following the sequencing process and got two incredibly disparate, you know, different sets of results, and that wasn't sufficient for them to say, you know what, we just can't really conclude anything based on this, because, you know, when we try to analyze and assemble the data, how do we know which one is correct? Yet they were biased going in, trying to look for what they believed was a pathogenic organism, a virus. So they said, okay, which one looks the most like a virus? And then, you know, kind of use that to guide their selection of which data set do we like the most and which, you know, so it was, I think it was Megahit that produced the longest sequence that wound up being the reference sequence. It was somewhere around 30,000 base pairs. But, you know, what's to say that the data that came out of Trinity that had a, you know, the biggest sequence was, you know, like 10,000 base pairs, that one wasn't correct or whatever. I mean, when you have that big of a difference, and then the fact that, you know, you're taking that and you're trying to search, you know, these databases, and, you know, it's all based on the same kind of findings going back and back and back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so many assumptions and layers and stuff that, I mean, it's so much easier to just accept stuff, I guess, when you're, and not peel it back and ask questions. I think a lot of scientists, it's just naive. You just believe that stuff is, you know, nobody's like intentionally, at least on the level of the lab, you know, the scientist or the lab tech or whatever, is trying to concoct some crazy thing or deceive. But when you know, if you're just blindly accepting data, or, you know, you have people that are above you that are saying, you know, we need to get this published, or you need to just say XYZ, I mean, yeah, then there's clearly something going on. But
right. And then getting back to the bias, they used that, what they determined to be the genome of the alleged virus, to create the primers for the PCR that they then used on the patient to determine that he was in fact sick with this virus, which is ludicrous when you think about it. It's, I think that goes beyond bias. I don't know exactly what you'd call it besides circular. It's certainly circular logic. It's certainly, It's certainly tautological, but again, I can't stress enough, and I know that you can't stress enough too, that we need to dig into this, because this is what is being used to control us and harm us, and in many cases kill us, in service of other agendas. That, yes, there's the pharma agenda involved, but it goes way bigger than that. And it's important that we understand the falseness, the fraudulence, the fraud that undergirds all of this, because there's something empowering about knowing that, and that what we're told by scientism is not anything that we have to listen to, other than to look at it critically and in most cases dismiss it after we've looked at it critically, because we can see that it just doesn't make any sense. So, Mike, we're about up to time, but what are you set to work on next? And I guess in brief, what is your goal with this series that you're working on?
So the next piece that I'm working on is about the reproducibility crisis, being that that's kind of the next progression. If you're going from Ioannidis says most studies are false, and then, you know, several years later we see the publication of actual findings that back that up and really clearly show that there is this replication crisis, that the great majority of papers can't be, or findings, you know, can't be reproduced. It kind of put a number to Ioannidis's claims, and because it turns out that, you know, one of the best ways to increase the likelihood that a finding is true is to try to reproduce it, to try to replicate it directly one-to-one, or to evaluate it from using different techniques and see if you get the same conclusion. And that it, you know, again, the majority of these things are just not reproducible. So that's a huge issue. And I think it's important to continue to flesh this out, because we rely heavily on papers and publications. I mean, people don't realize that any given paper that you pick up, I mean, has a better than not chance of either being totally false or at least having major claims be invalid. And if you're just taking that and accepting that, well, we see where that can lead. And
yes,
so I'm hoping, Mike, to show people the problems.
Great. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I hate to cut you off, but thank you so much for speaking with me today. And I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's great to join you again.